time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit, and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation, all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Outloud. Well, President Trump orders action against Iran. The strike was called off with planes in the air. Is this a sign of strength or weakness? And the debate you can hear from sea to shun and sea people. Reparations. The debt's been paid already, some are saying. But does some form of compensation need to be made to the descendants of Africans that were trafficked and enslaved in America? Pretty hot debate up on the Hill, and people are talking on the water coolers about this one. And then, did you know that dogs can detect cancer in the body even up to a year before it's detected by humans? That's right. Man's best friend, they say, can sniff out up to 97% of cancer in humans. Could be a wave of the future, people. Let's get to the top story here, please. And it is Iran. Welcome on Colonel Jim Warshak. He's retired from the United States Air Force. He's a career senior intelligence and special missions officer. Served as deputy director for intelligence for U.S. Central Command. Worked on the White House National Security Council. President Trump tweeted out on Monday, Iran, shot down an unmanned drone flying in international waters. We were cocked and loaded to retaliate last night on three different sites when I asked how many will die. 150 people, sir, was the answer from a general. This was, they say, 10 minutes before the strike, and he says, I stopped it. One of the things, and one of the criticisms I'm hearing a great deal of, and we've touched on this prior, but is that there's a remarkable level of detail being released on this, especially with these split decisions and that sort of thing. Is this a good thing, Colonel Warshak? I mean, how much do the American people need to know? And are we given too much? Because, again, Iran is listening to every word he says, and so is every other adversary.
We have a situation, and I'm glad to be back on the show. We have a situation here where things are essentially turning on a dime. And this president and this country is in a precarious situation where at one point, we're trying to do everything to tamp down any effort by Iran to escalate this. And they are trying to escalate this because they are having a horrendous internal problem due to the sanctions that the U.S. has put on them as a result of the Iran nuclear deal. It's creating serious problems.
Now, let's hold that thought right there. Now, I want to ask you something about what you just said, because on last Thursday, President Trump described Iran's shoot down of the U.S. drone over the Straits of Hormuz as a very big mistake and an unintentional error, he said, by someone who was loose and stupid. Now, I want to just ask you straight out, following up on what you just said. Do you really think this was an accident or was this intentional on Iran's part?
Oh, it was intentional. And the president's justification for what he said was basically handing Iran an opportunity to de-escalate the situation. He realized that this is a tit-for-tat situation where anything we would do, Iran is going to do something else. They're going to either use their proxies in Yemen or Hezbollah or other Quds forces to do some form of operations against a number of targets across the region. And so the president has the intelligence available to him that's been telling him what's been going on. This has been going on for several months. You know, we've talked about this before, this increase of U.S. forces to the region. It's been going on since at least April. We had the intelligence available to this, and that's what's been driving that. And just getting back to the point is, Iran is in a situation where they're backed in a corner. The sanctions are having tremendous impact on their economy, and they're now thrusting out in any way they can to try to cause us to reduce those sanctions and pull them back. And all they have is the threat of hostile action. So we're dealing with a regime that is, as I said, up against the wall. The president is playing things on a minute-by-minute basis and trying to do so without causing them to do something further. And so I think that's what you're really seeing here. Now, I guarantee you, we had targets selected on the ground, and we were going to surgically strike those because they were an important type of missile that we needed to get out of there, because they could shoot at anything. They could shoot down an airliner. They could shoot down other military aircraft, cargo planes, things that are, and they demonstrated a very sophisticated capability. They were able to take out this type of drone, an RQ-4 Global Hawk, that is designed to fly above the capability of those missiles, and the Iranians were able to do that. So this had nothing to do about whacking Iran for shooting the drone down. This was going to be a response to remove a major threat to anything that flies in the region that Iran.
Well, on to your point there, the State Department had released a message that warned all the airlines not to fly in that area of the Middle East, period. And that's exactly what you're saying, that they were afraid that, you know, Iran might take an airline down, a jet or something that, you know, it could even be an accident, but it could very well be intentional as well. And that certainly happened before. So there was a lot of rerouting of air routes and that sort of thing around the Middle East that play into your point, Jim. You know, so they have to. There's a lot of unknowns with Iran, but let's talk about this desperation. There is a desperation coming out of Iran. Obviously, the Iranian people. We covered this really in detail last week on Viewpoint. The Iranian people are hurting very, very much. We reported on that. It's clear that they are lashing out. In fact, a lot of people don't realize the China impact. China has met with Zarif, just as I reported just weeks ago, last month here, and talked about China, said they would have their back and help them or what have you. And I think China's sort of edging this on a little bit, aren't they, Jim?
Well, certainly, you know, China is having its problems too, dealing with the tough stance that President Trump is playing with China with regard to tariffs and trade issues. China needs Iran's oil and gasoline products and other petroleum type based products. So they need this to fuel, you know, their nation, their military. And so they have that arrangement with Iran.
Don't you think this has given Iran more confidence, is what I'm saying, with China? Don't you think that's got back to the certainly the Ayatollah and Rouhani? I mean, they realize China's in their court, don't they? Right?
Well, they know they have China in their court, and they also know they have Russia in their court. And so they have two big powers in the world who are on their side. That's right. But they can only do so. They can only do so much. Russia is technology driven, and when I say that, meaning military and energy type capabilities. China is trade, and oil is a big factor there, but really that's about it. And the Iranians are seeing what China is going through in their dealings with Iran, and they're seeing, well, wow, this guy named Donald Trump is really playing hardball with the Chinese, and now we're dealing with him on this. This is really his real first challenge with Iran. And so here's this guy, and I've talked about this before, and I describe it in the Trump doctrine. Here's someone who can play that 5 to 8 level chess game at one time, right, with different players. And so you have this situation with Iran, where Iran is not only desperate physically from what the sanctions are doing, they're somewhat desperate because they're watching their other allies in the region kind of being played too by Trump. You know, we had Japanese President Abe visiting Iran last week when this whole incident happened, with the intention of he was working with the U.S. Secretary of State to help bring Iran to the table to talks. He was kind of the mediator. He was serving as a an ambassador on behalf of the U.S.
And that's as they hit one of his national tankers in the Straits there.
And
pretty striking.
He basically asked Iran, "Will you sit at the table with the U.S.?" Remember, a long time ago, Donald Trump said, "I'm willing to sit down with anybody."
Right,
he's proven that by sitting down with, you know, he sat down with Putin. He sat down with Kim Jong-un. And so they see this is a person who is not an adversarial person in nature, who's willing to sit down and try to talk. They didn't want to sit down and talk. They took that as an insult. How dare you come here on behalf of America and try to tell us to sit down with America? Watch what we're going to do to you. And they went and attacked his own tanker while he's sitting on Iranian.
That's exactly it. See, a lot of this doesn't serve Iran's goal, Jim. Let's face it, their goals are very clear. They, you know, the thing nobody really talks about is the elephant in the room, is they put their goals right out there, what they want to do with Israel and death to America and what their ultimate goal is. And we've talked about this ideology and this philosophy that they're not afraid to die, the Iranians and their people, and put their people at risk. They have no value of human life there whatsoever, which is part and parcel of the problem with Iran. Here's the question I want to ask you about. Trump comes out, he tells the Iranian officials, tell Reuters that Tehran has received a message from Trump warning that the U.S. attack on Iran was imminent, but says that Trump is against war, which we believe that's the case, and he wanted talks on a range of issues. My question to you is, I mean, let's be real here. What are talks going to accomplish with Iran? I mean, what about us facing the truth? Iran, they want this conflict. They don't want to talk. They've made it clear. They're looking for a conflict. And that's why you just talked about Russia and China. I mean, I think we're at a tipping point. And I mean, I don't think a lot of people realize that this is how world wars get started right here, right now.
Here's what Trump, his whole perspective on this, and as I mentioned a minute or two ago, that he's willing to talk with anybody. One of the things Trump wants to do, and this is just him, just his nature. This isn't about pro-Trump or favoring Trump. He approaches it from this point. He knows who the enemies are. Mm-hmm. He knows who are the threats to the U.S. and to our allies and interests in the world. Mm-hmm. But he wants them to prove it themselves. He wants them to show the world who you really are. You always come out and say, we're for peace in the world. Mm-hmm. It's always the big, bad, ugly United States. You show me.
That's a great point.
I'm going to say, you know, he's doing this with
I agree with that.
He's doing this with Putin. He's doing this with everybody. I'm going to let you prove. If he can sit down and Iran stops everything, Iran's basically proven they're not the bad guy anymore. But we all know that's not going to be the case, and he knows it too. He just wants the world to see for itself the U.S. is not the bad guy.
Jim, I think that's well said. Now, you helped listeners right there understand why he does some of the things he does. If you equate that with, as you said earlier, he's always playing to 5 to 8 level chess. But what's really odd about all this, though, is that he plays it in the public purview. He throws it in the public square, and people clearly don't know what to do with that. But again, you've got this multi-level program going on. Let me tell you, the speaker, Pelosi, comes out. She says this, and I quote, "The president seems to suggest that he found out about apparently the death toll if they had gone through with the strike moments before they conducted the strike. Isn't that something you think he should have known about beforehand?" She says. Interesting question she puts out there, the speaker does. And this is before she urged Trump to, and these are her words, "take a deep breath and de-escalate." Now, the Republican Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz comes out. He tweeted his support of the president with this: "We do not need to go to war with Iran over an unmanned drone," which you already pointed out, Colonel. He said, "until we have more information, I am done." And listen to these words: "I am done with endless unconstitutional regime change wars in the Middle East," he wrote. Now, that's a hell of a point Gaetz puts out there, if you ask me. So now you've got this fight going on with, again, the neocons and the others who are pushing and pushing and pushing, the hawks. They want conflict with Iran. And then you have others. And in a lot of ways, I think the Democrat Party hasn't been as loud on this. In other words, he's not playing a traditional Republican route here, is he, Jim?
No, not at all. And you know, this gets back to where I talked about where Trump is wanting the hostile foreign leaders and nations to reveal themselves. He's also playing this, as you mentioned, he's been right out in the open in all of this. He's playing to the hostile U.S. media. He wants them come out and report honestly what's going on. Don't play spin it. Don't play you're the lead for the Democrats in America. Come out and report honestly based on what's going on. And he's doing the same thing with Pelosi and Congress and the Democrats. And we saw before he stood down in this situation, they were saying don't go to war, don't escalate. The minute he said for humanitarian reasons, potential unnecessary death on the ground, I've terminated this operation, they immediately switched. You're not strong enough. You right. Backed down. Right. They're playing a political game 100%. You know who their least interest is? America. They don't care of America's standing in the world. And Trump knows that. And so he has got to play this. Now I will be the first to tell you this. When he asked the fact that he supposedly asked how many people would die in this as a result of not doing this, that in and of itself was a cover story. The real reason he didn't do this is because the minute-by-minute intelligence he was getting said that the targets that we selected to strike were moved. They were mobile targets, and they moved. And they moved them because someone, and I'm not going to mention who, someone leaked the fact that we were going to go out to strike, conduct measured strikes against select targets. And the Iranians knew exactly what that was, and they moved those targets at the last minute. And for us to send our military force to take those out would have resulted in deaths on the ground, whether they would have moved people there just like Hamas and Hezbollah do with human targets on the ground put them out there for the purpose of being killed, or the fact that we would have walked into an ambush, which we learned how capable the Iranian missiles are to be able to take down drones. Would we send our own fighters into that after those targets were moved? We would not have been able to acquire them because it takes a little bit of time to recalculate those. He turned it off. That was a postured reason for doing that, but it served the purpose of trying to de-escalate. It sent a message to Iran that, you know what, we're more concerned about your people than you are. And it sent a message to Congress saying, look, I'm not here to escalate, nor to the neocons am I here to escalate. I'm here to do what America needs to do, and I did it. And it gets back to, are we going to get into a conflict? Because I guarantee you, this could escalate to something based on how Iran takes it, and we have to be 2, 3, 4 steps ahead of Iran on how we conduct ourselves in this. We're going to prevail in the long run, I believe, with the president, and that's my one plug for this president is because he's playing this game, and it's a game. Spying is a game. Everything goes in spying until you get caught, and we got caught. But we get caught a lot of times, and so do other countries. Nobody talks about the 175-plus planes that were shot down during the Cold War over the Soviet Union with over 200 Americans killed. Nobody ever talks about that because we never revealed that to anybody. It wasn't until 1998 when those stories started coming out. This is all part of a game that nations play, and we play very heavily in it because we're the United States of America. No shoot down of any aircraft, be it a manned aircraft or a drone, has ever escalated into a conflict. And for this to escalate into a conflict, it's more on the part of the neocons in this country who want to escalate into a conflict than Iran. Iran has no idea what it's going to do. They're just going to respond in some way, shape, or form because they want to, they're playing to the same media and to the same world leaders to say, look at us and look what we're doing. Trying to show is you're the bad guys and you're proving it yourself.
Yeah, well, there's public perception is what we're saying. And obviously their back is against the wall and they need to do something, Iran does. And this is their cry out there. But again, when you look back at the basics of this and the ideology behind all this, it's hard to believe that anything is ever going to change when you want somebody dead. And it's hard to sit down and talk with people who want you dead as well. I mean, that always is the ultimate challenge here when you're dealing with Iran. You know, Jim, we've been talking about Iran and the Middle East well before I was in diapers. This has been going on for our lifetimes and everybody else's lifetime as well. Not very hopeful, is it, that this will ever be anywhere? I mean, this is really a lost cause, isn't it, the Middle East?
Perhaps. I think, as you noted, mm-hmm. what Congressman Gates said was, you know, mm-hmm. one of the things we have to get out of the business is doing this regime change, which for the most part really took off extensively during the previous administration. Surprisingly, that's where it came from.
Yeah.
Trump made a campaign promise that he was going to get us out of and not allow us to get into these kind of situations, whether they're small conflicts or we're going to get involved in regime change. I guarantee one of the things that the U.S. is hoping to, there's regime change all over the world. It's going on for centuries.
And right.
It happens more so internally than by an outside adversary.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been plenty of opportunities for the Iranians to internally to stand up. They don't like their government any more than we do.
No, they don't. The people don't, clearly.
Well, yeah. You know, of course, they have the indoctrinated loyalists and followers, as you would in any nation who mm-hmm. are there, because there's, you know, I believe that drone that was shot down was not shot down over international waters. It may not finally have been hit until it was over international waters and it was exiting Iran, because it doesn't do any good to fly a drone over international waters. You're not going to see anything. We've already got more ships on the Persian Gulf to have a view on that tight 21-mile wide strip called the Strait of Hormuz to see every single ship that is in there, be it Iranian or other country.
So, and based on what you just said, that would mean Iran was in their right to do what they did.
Of course.
There you go.
But that's not the point. And it gets back to, we do that. Drones, like any other
spider,
are risk averse.
Right.
And that's an expectation that we plan on.
Yeah, no, you've made that clear. I just want to point out to people that the obvious here that may not be so obvious to people, Colonel. That's why I say that. Listen, last thought in our moment here. Where do you see this going? What happens next?
You know, this all depends on Iran. It doesn't depend on America. It depends on how we respond to whatever Iran does. You know, you have to look at, now Iran can do other things. You know, I believe Iran will try in every way it can escalate this. Will they attack another tanker? Perhaps. Will they lob missiles into another power plant in Saudi Arabia? Will Hezbollah do something against Israel? Will the Houthis do something in Yemen or Saudi Arabia? Mm-hmm. Iran is going to, we may sit here for days and weeks and nothing happens. And it diffuses the situation. Mm-hmm. And time and inactivity diffuse situations.
Big thank you here to Colonel Jim Warshak here. More Viewpoint in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
The Out Loud perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutloud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio. You almost can never tell what's going to be next on the national debate or what people are going to be talking about at the water cooler. But if you had told me it would be about reparations, I would not probably have believed it. But that is exactly the conversation that is happening right now, is reparations. And so the discussion is that potentially reparations should be paid to the Africans that were enslaved and is here in America. And of course, there's a lot that people don't know about this because America wasn't really even the biggest player in this field. But this happened throughout the world. And, you know, the repercussions of this can only be magnified by, if you went back to the beginning of time, my friends, you would have to do reparations for everybody. I mean, conquest has been part of the human mode from the very beginning. And so where do you stop this? Or where do you start it, actually? Well, there's a hearing that's been conducted by the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. The bill discussed H.R. 40 would task a commission with studying the continual effects of slavery and racial discrimination and make recommendations about what redress might be needed here. Let's bring on here a gentleman who wrote a very interesting piece about this, Del Wilber. Del is a former CIA and Department of Defense Intelligence and Counterterrorism officer. This story you put out there about reparations was, I mean, you laid out a very compelling case. You talked about some very interesting things I want to talk to you about now. Specifically, this bill, one of the things that there's a lot of symbolism in this bill now, and it goes on to say that there's an unfulfilled 154-year-old federal promise of 40 acres and a mule, which we've all heard that, to recently freed men and women. Now, this bill has been hanging around for a while, actually, but now there's a push to get it through. And it was reintroduced by Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee. But it's been, it's been played out here for some time here. What do you think? Are they just bored, or what's the ultimate goal of this or the purpose? Because a lot of the presidential candidates on the left have picked up on it and running with it as well.
Well, it's obvious that we're entering an election season, and it's nothing more than an attempt by the Democrats to buy votes, buy the African-American vote. And, it's just it's despicable. I mean, that's no different than the old, I think I mentioned before that, the old party precinct captain who on election day used to walk around the city with a pocket full of money, buying drinks for everybody and that. I mean, that was nothing but blatant, politics and attempts to buy votes. And that's what this is.
You know, that's as you get an election season, you're right. They're always pulling things out to try to grab those votes. If this even happened, and I mean, I don't know how this would happen, but if it did, I mean, where and when would it stop? Where do you stop something like this, Dale? And how do you,
Well, I mean, I think you open up a huge can of worms because there's going to be lots of other people who are going to claim an aggrieved status.
We'd have to go back to the cavemen, Dale. We'd have to go back to the cavemen. And before then,
Exactly. And, first of all, let me say up front, nobody's justifying slavery or anything. I know you're not. I'm not.
No.
It was a horrible stain on the history of our nation. But certainly not. We're not the only country in the world back in earlier history that practiced slavery. I mean, and blacks were not the only race that slavery was practiced against. Every conquering nation throughout history enslaved other people. So it's not something unique to African Americans. And again, it was a terrible part of our history. But it's time to put that behind us and move forward, until the black community can do that, they're going to continually have problems in trying to attain the American dream.
Right. In your piece, you talk about the debt being already paid. Let's go through that a minute. How do you believe the debt has already been paid?
Well, I mentioned about the Civil War, obviously, and certainly it wasn't fought, at least initially or solely for the purpose of freeing the slaves. But ultimately, that's what it became about. And, it became about that because it was slavery was an institution that the South depended upon. And Abraham Lincoln, President Lincoln at the time, recognized that in order to return the Confederate States to the Union, it was going to have to defeat them not only militarily on the battlefield, but by taking away their means of economic progress, and that through the slavery would help to achieve the goal on the battlefield. So it ultimately became about slavery. And there was several hundred thousand Union soldiers that were killed as a result of that war. I mentioned my great-grandfather who fought for the Union and was wounded twice at two of the major engagements. He also fought at Chancellorsville and Fredericksburg and was wounded at Antietam and was wounded seriously at Gettysburg and had to basically sit out the remainder of the war. But, you know, he's just one of hundreds of thousands of soldiers who were killed, wounded, or maimed as a result of that that conflict.
Yeah, you talk about your great-grandfather in the article. I thought that was really interesting. In fact, you even have a picture of him, great-grandfather Henry Wilbur. And I like the way you covered that. And I thought it was very unique to show that history and that part of that very much. There was a very interesting article in the Chicago Sun-Times by a writer, John W. Fountain. And the title of this one, Dell, is Reparations? How about an end to the murder of us by us? Now, this is a Black American here, and a lot of Black Americans are upset and offended by this whole idea of reparations. They're insulted by it, and they don't wish to play victim any further. They want to get on, as you just described moments ago, with life. And there's a great piece of the populace of Black Americans, as there really would be with any group, I think, that would stand up and say, you know, not so fast. We're not interested in a handout. We want to get on with life. It really comes back to, again, the equality of all of us being able to do what we want to do in life. So, you know, so I want to read you this here from this article from John Fountain here. He says this: what good are reparations to a dead man? To a people whose sons and daughters, gunned down in genocidal proportions, will never breathe again. When these streets run with a generation's blood, like gutters gushing with summer rain, he says, insane. And this was really something else. He got into this thing and talked about, let us take a more imminent cause, the murder of us by us, the slaying of African-American sons, largely by African-American sons. In what amounts to a mass shooting nearly every freaking weekend. Those are his words now. Black lives don't matter to Black people. Damn. So why should Black lives matter to anyone else? They must matter to us first. That's a hell of an argument to put up, Del Wilbur.
Well, you know, I agree. I mean, the urban areas in this country have become almost a free fire zone. And unfortunately, it's a situation where, sadly, many innocent bystanders, you know, you hear about young children who are hit by a stray bullet or whatever because they're just indiscriminate in their use of, you know, guns to try to get even some score for some insult or some slight that took place in that. And, I mean, it goes back to, you know, the entire Black community, what has befallen them. And I use that term befallen them because I really do think it's been a tragedy. Was the start of the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson, when, you know, the Black community was actually improving their station in life, and they were starting to become more of the fabric of America. And then Lyndon Johnson comes and starts instituting all these programs, which basically destroyed the Black family.
And has it ever recovered from that?
No, it's gone downhill since. I mean, just all one has to do is look around. There, you know, there are certainly examples of many, you know, African Americans who have risen above the, you know, the
big
problems
time.
Of their
big
community.
Time.
Yeah, and so we're not detracting from them at all. But certainly some of the inner city areas in that still. Mm-hmm. Suffer from, you know, from the effects of that.
Well, I like where John Fountain, the author of this article, went from the Sun-Times. I like where he went because what he's really talking about here, and let's talk about this a moment here. He's talking about, let's put the attention where the attention should be. Let's put the effort where the effort should be. Let's focus on what's important. And what he's really doing is talking about current day. So if you think about the article, I thought it was one of the best ones I've seen out there from a great Black American who says, wait a minute here. And he's bringing the conversation back to what's important. See, nobody's talking about our urban cities and our markets and what's going on. And of course, Chicago has been well documented. It's not the only city. There's a lot of cities. I mean, the crime in Baltimore is through the roof. The crime in Philadelphia is the worst in the nation. So a lot of urban markets have this problem. And I think what John did in this case, Dale, is he brought it back to that denominator. But, you know, we don't do that in this country. We spend time on what I call water cooler talk and things that are not going to improve the lives of anybody. I mean, do you ever see, I mean, this reparations thing, this what they're trying to do, this effort to put it into play here with this bill, H.R. 40. I mean, what are the chances of this happening? Do you see, I mean, is this just a smoke and mirrors game, or do you think there's any real possibility this would happen?
No, it's never going to happen. And it is, as I said, it's an election year scam, basically. And all it is to try to get, you know, some black people thinking, wow, if I vote Democrat, I'm going to get me some money. And that's a bunch of garbage. I mean, what they're doing is instead of inspiring, you know, black people, young black men and that to achieve greater things than that, they're offering them, you know, a placebo or something, if that's the right term. But, you know, it's not going to happen. And even if it did happen, it wouldn't achieve anything.
No, it doesn't achieve anything. I mean, I guess this is some people and some Democrats are saying it's going to right the wrongs somehow. I mean, listen, if we tried to right the wrongs for everything that was wrong in this history of the Republic, we'd spend the rest of our lives trying to fix what we couldn't possibly fix. So the whole thing, what we're saying is this whole thing about the reparations is what you point out, Dale. It's an election time scam. But what they're doing is they're pulling the effort in and they're getting the hopes up of some people. Because, you know, part of the problem, Dale, is a lot of these people only read the headlines. I mean, they don't really understand the argument, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I truly, first of all, no one's denying that, you know, like I said, slavery was a terrible stain on our nation's history. Mm-hmm. And the decades of discrimination that followed, okay? Nobody's denying that black people had a rough way to go, you know, throughout our history. But in the last several decades, the black community in America, compared to anywhere else in the world, mm-hmm. has risen and achieved, you know, a greater status. And mm-hmm. and it was continuing, you know. Yeah. Are there racists out there? Absolutely. There are individual racists. There always has been and there always will be. You know, you can't change every person's heart. But racism as a societal practice and as an institution mm-hmm. has been gone for many years now. People just don't give a darn what color somebody is anymore.
That's right. That's right. You and I certainly don't. Let me ask you this here question. It just came to my thought process here. We hear the term a lot today about white privilege, and that comes up a lot. In fact, it's been a very, very prominent headline and a talking point that you hear, white privilege. And I think a lot about that. And I think about as a young boy, Dale, when I started realizing a couple of my friends that were black and friends that were white, I really didn't know there was a big color difference between all of us. I mean, it just seemed like it was part of life. As kids, you don't really notice things. It's sort of until adults point it out and corrupt your young mind. You know what I mean, Dale? The kids wouldn't know any different. But I often wondered as a kid, as you discovered the racism does exist and did exist back then, and it exists today, and probably always exists for whatever reason. It seems to be one of those evils of mankind. What is it that makes some people think that one race is better than another? I mean, where does that all come from, that thinking? I've asked that question to myself all my life, and I've never gotten a really any idea. I mean, because you hear now this white privilege comment, now we're talking about reparations, and we're talking about raising communities up. But there are a lot of communities that are struggling. It's not just, you know, and that have suffered and come through difficult times. What is it that does that with humankind, you think, human beings? It's a strange thing, isn't it?
I don't, you know, the only color privilege that I think really exists out there is green privilege,
and that's, I like and it,
and that's money.
You're not talking Martians, are you, buddy?
No, you know, I mean, it's a fact. I mean, people that have money are able to open doors that others can't. I grew up, you know, I mean, we were probably my dad was a truck driver, my mom was a secretary, so we certainly weren't wealthy by any stretch of the imagination. We lived paycheck to paycheck, and you know, I never felt that I wanted for anything. My parents did always did their best to try to provide for us and that. But you know, I grew up, I had black babysitters when I was a little kid, that my mom and dad, because they both worked, you know, they would drop us off, and So I grew up in that environment. I played with their kids. I never really understood or paid any attention to the fact that their skin was darker than mine. And my parents certainly didn't profess any feelings that they were different. And in school that I went to, and that, again, it was, I went to an integrated school, grade school, high school. So I had black friends. I played sports, blacks, and the only people that had privilege were the ones that lived in the affluent communities.
You bring up a very good point, and it should make everybody think. The only privilege really out there, I like that, is green privilege. Because money talks, and you know what walks people, right? I mean, think about that, what Dell says there. And that should give us all a thought when we talk about privilege, what really is privilege. And again, it's something that I think the power seekers and the power holders use to divide people. And I'll say it again, and I've said it before, and that's exactly what I think race is all about. I think it's just a divided mechanism that powerful people use to divide the classes. I've seen it happen. You've seen it happen on the Barack Obama watch. You've seen it happen with all in our cities from Ferguson on forward. You've seen it from other markets. And he's not the first one. It's happened in a lot of administrations. And it happens a lot from the far left. They use this race and they use things to divide the American people, sadly. And none of it makes any sense when you really think about it. But that seems to be what this reparations is all about, another mechanism to divide people, or as Del Wilber pointed out, to gather the votes, because it is election season after all, friends. Well, listen, another very interesting story up next on Viewpoint is, this was fascinating to me because I had no idea this was really happening to the level that it's happening. I mean, I've heard little rumblings of this, but nothing like this here. The progress being made with man's best friend, with dogs, and the fact that they can sniff up to 97% of cancer in humans, it's being said. They're able to detect cancer in the body even up to a year before it's detected by humans. And I've seen the videos of this. It is very, very fascinating what's happening here with this remarkable progress that's being made with cancer here. I think it's a story that we should cover here, and we'll do that next, friends, on Viewpoint.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@americaoutloud.com.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
Welcome back to Viewpoint, friends. And listen, I want to point out to you all the incredible, authors, columnists, all of our show hosts, bloggers, just incredible people on America Out Loud. This is definitely a place you want to come to check out the latest here. And we've got quite an array and family of unique people that are out there. Again, I always say your truth, my truth, his truth, her truth, but it is some level of truth we have to believe, correct? Everybody's got a truth, is my point here. But we're happy to bring all that to you at America Out Loud, from sea to shining sea, as I always say here. And so listen, up next, I want to talk to you about a very interesting article, and one of our very own here to talk about this. This was really interesting to me. Because I didn't know it was at this level. And in fact, there's quite a unique video attached to this from the BBC that I think is definitely worthy of your time, as well as a lot of background information. And it is about man's best friend, our dogs, being able to really detect early signs. You know, one of the challenges with cancer is that you don't get it early enough. And that's one of the problems. And if you can get it early enough, then we all have a chance to hopefully escape more pain and sometimes death. And the way to do that is maybe through these dogs. And the ratios of success here we're seeing is unparalleled, I think. I'm very interested here. Please welcome on Susan Price. Susan is an investigative researcher here at America Out Loud. She's a columnist. Susan's a patriot, a veteran advocate, and Gold Star mother. Susan always finds the gold lining in every story, and she always finds the unique stories as well. So, Susan, let's tell people right now, explain to us, how are these dogs, first of all, detecting cancer? How are they doing it?
Oh, geez, Malcolm, this is an amazing pioneering field. The dogs have, they're olfactory, their senses are such greater than man's that they can detect up to a year the cancer in the blood, but not just cancer, they can detect diabetes and strokes and just all kinds of disorders in the human body. So nobody really knows exactly how they do it, but they're trained in a certain way, rigorous, intense training. And once they're trained and let loose, and, you know, service dogs, let's be honest, after the Gulf War, how many service dogs? That's a big business. And they're allowing veterans to live a healthy, normal life. And so since about 2004 is when the pioneering time took off, and now we're moving into other arenas where these dogs are becoming a very big part of the medical community, and they'll be using them more in labs and throughout hospitals and others to help medical professionals.
Right. Susan, you know, one thing I want to put out there is, if we all think about it a moment, dogs have incredible senses. So when we say how do they do it, let's touch on that a moment here, because I think that, as you just said, olfactory here, the dogs, their smell, but also their hearing, right. And their smell is far superior to a lot of humans, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's, 25 times more greater than a human being's, but it allows them hundreds of thousands of times when you multiply cubic square inches of smell, however they get the math on that. It's just amazing.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, my little guy, I have a Chinese crested, Zachary, Susan, you know. Oh, yeah, I don't know I think you know that, but Zachary is my Chinese crested. And he has got the incredible hearing, as most dogs do. And there are times you hear nothing, and yet you right away he's on alert, he hears everything. So the senses of dogs are incredible. Now, the dogs that are doing this on cancer now, there are specific dogs, and you mentioned in your piece there are five dog teams, you call it, that consist of various groups. What are those groups? Can you tell us?
Well, Malcolm, these would be the German Shepherds, Australian Shepherd, Shepherd Lab Mix,
okay,
Beagles, and Belgium Milanese, and also mixed breed dogs containing any combination of the names I just listed.
So there are certain instincts in those dogs they're using. And now when I see the video, the dogs are going around in circles and they're going around with all the, and I mean, you literally can see, you can see it right on the video, how they're like,
right.
For instance, give me an example here, urine scent. So they have in the various apparatus on a piece of equipment, like, I don't know, like 10 or 12 of them or something. And the dog goes around in circles and sniffs each one, and then he points out which one has the cancer. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yes. There's certain elements, compounds within the urine,
right,
that can that detect that there's a cancer enzyme in there. Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the early detection is coming from then. And we're talking accuracy here of 97, 98, 99%. That's like,
yeah,
that's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, that far beats a machine.
Astounding? Well, and they can actually test even up to a year before. That's what is so astounding.
Early detection.
Because, yes, we don't even have that with our medical, devices. And that up to a year ahead of time, it's crazy.
No, that's what makes this so interesting. Now, within your research you've done on this story, one of the things I'm wondering here is cancer is big business and big money to a lot of people. Let's call it big healthcare, because we know what that means, and big healthcare, big pharma, big all of it. And it's big money, cancer is. In fact, quite frankly, Susan, and you probably have read some of these reports as well, I've read reports and studies where there are a lot of times we're close to maybe solving cancer or have some sort of an answer, but it's never pushed forward because big cancer, big money, big pharma, they don't want some of that stuff solved because it's a big, we're talking, you know, billions and billions of dollars here of life.
Right.
It comes back to greenbacks. So my question here is, I wonder how the medical community is or is not embracing this. I got to imagine there's some out there who are not happy about these, because this could change a few things. What do you think?
Well, we know that there's going to be changes, because just for one, living in America, we know that President Trump is a big thing for him to break down big pharma. But I'm sure there's a little bit of resistance, or a lot of resistance, but some of these bigwigs, we know that there are cancer cures. We know that. And for me to say that, yeah, that's a bold statement, because it's true. We have herbs and everything. It's been proven over and over through the years.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we will, in the next 5 years, see this. It's there now. They're working on these things.
Yeah.
So it will make a big debut.
And early,
it's every type of cancer.
Every type of cancer too, right? And early detection is the whole key here to really curing cancer. I mean, if you get it early, then your chances of you know, being successful is skyrockets. I mean, especially some cancers that when they find it, it's too late because it's ravaged the body and all, you know. You mentioned a doctor in your article here, Dr. Cynthia Otto. She's out of the,
right.
She's a director of the University of Pennsylvania School of the Veterinarian Medicine here.
Right.
And it's a working dog center. She says this. She says, I absolutely believe that dogs can detect cancer. The big question is, how will we use them in the battle to fight cancer? So that's the question she's putting on there. How would you answer that question yourself?
Oh my gosh. We're just going to all have to wait to see how it all pans out, because she's aware with Big Pharma, the war that goes on behind the lines, but miracles are about to happen and unfold, and we're going to witness them. And from man's best friend, and not from scientific data, you know, nature. Yeah.
You also put out there, there are some incredible stories that people need to read as you research this. Now, let me say this, and for folks who are in question or maybe suspect, Susan, that maybe they could have cancer or something isn't quite right, this is something they should check into and ask their physicians about and how to go about this. And I don't know, how available is all this right now? If you wanted to do this as a person, could you ask for this sort of detection service? I mean, is this readily available, do you know?
Well, you know, most doctors are not aware yet of all the agencies. This is a brand new field that's emerging, believe it or not. And you know what the sin of it all is, Malcolm? Listen, we have bomb-sniffing dogs, drug-sniffing, cadaver. Why not something that sustains life on an everyday basis? So this is a field that's opening, and you just have to try to check out with different veterinarian groups that may be associated, because this is how new this is, even though Europeans started researching first.
Is that right? Yeah. They were ahead of the curve on this, huh?
Wow. They were ahead of the curve.
Well, the story from the BBC kind of says that, because they do a great job of putting that out there. You also list some case studies, some incredible stories in the article here.
Yeah.
For instance, you have one story I want to share with people, a 40-year-old woman from Rochester, Minnesota, was studying for a test when her dog began nosing at her left side and acting strangely. When the woman brushed away the dog, she felt a lump and subsequently received a diagnosis of breast cancer.
Exactly. One of millions of stories. There's millions of stories, and this is a global thing. from Europe to Asia to the United States. This is, you know, this is becoming big business. And look at, there's a woman in Amherst, New York, my neck of the woods. Mm-hmm. And there was a red spot on the woman's nose,
right,
prompting her to get the bump checked. And the dog kept on touching that area. And here it was skin cancer. So, I mean,
right,
the dogs are incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, and this other one, I like this a lot because this was a black lab named Marine was able to detect colon cancer, and they're specifically spelling a colon cancer, which is a very difficult cancer, and you got to get that early. And this, in a study of 200 humans who suffered from this disease with an incredible 97% accuracy rate, this one study from U.S. News and World Report mentioned here, and we're talking some stats here that you're laying out here that are just incredibly amazing and accurate to me. So I got to believe there's people behind this now that are going to push this out there where the dogs can, in other words, cancer detection services. I mean, this has got to become a business onto its own right now.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the question is, how do you get these, as you mentioned, veterinarian groups and others to be able to, and how do you get to your doctor, your MD, your general practitioner, your internal medicine doctor, and, you know, right, and get those answers that you need. There must be groups. I mean, that's really the question now is how do you bring this all to the forefront?
Well, it's going on. I know there's thousands of researchers and that such working on this, but it's so new. I mean, if you Google it, it's really hard to find. There's not that many groups. And so anybody that wants to invest into big business, this would be one of them to, you know, network and get it out there.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point.
Collaborate with doctors, veterinarian groups, and then your market of people that have dogs that are in service dogs. That I have a friend that owns a canine service company. What a big business. I can't even tell you. They're just... Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There are definitely some business opportunities for folks, and this could be another one of these here, right here with the dogs here. But I find the story incredibly fascinating. And to me, people, is that if we can find some hope and some future for cancer, and if we can detect these things early, then there's the success metrics go up. They, again, skyrocket here. And that's one of the things that we got to hope for. I think there's a lot of revolutionary things that are happening, but they don't happen fast enough, quite frankly, for me. I'd like to see some of these things happen quicker, faster, so we can save lives. You know, I mean, we can all appreciate that, what it takes to do this kind of a thing. So a big thank you here to Susan Price and for bringing this story to light here. You'll find all kinds of unique stories back at America Out Loud. And that's really the beauty of this platform, friends, is that it's everything. It's lifestyle, it's health and wellness, it's business. There's more to life than just politics. And it's time to get involved and get loud.